Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, if you haven't already, you got to go to our Patreon page, sign up, and get a copy of the Patreon app on your cell phone so you can participate in the brand new chat room in the Patreon app. Lots of things going on over there on the Patreon page. And by the way, one of the best ways to unwind after a week of relentless chaos is, of course, the After Party podcast presented exclusively on our Patreon page. It's a commercial-free 90-minute podcast every Friday, and it's kind of like eavesdropping on an evening chat between me and my girlfriend, Kimberly Johnson. It's far more personal than the free shows with all kinds of revelations about our personal lives, but with all the latest political commentary in there, too. And it can get really weird and fun. So don't miss out. Subscribe to the After Party level at patreon.com/BobSeskaShow. And you're also going to get 2 Shadow Docket episodes included in that level of support every single week. Again, it's patreon.com/BobSeskaShow. And now let the cartoons begin.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Did you ever see anything about Seska that made you suspicious?
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, October 25, 2023, and this is the Bob Seska Interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, day 1008 of the Biden-Harris administration, 376 days until the 24th presidential election. You can find me on Threads and Instagram. The Bob Seska is my name there. Twitter, Bob Seska _ go. Spoutable Bob Seska. Our Patreon page is BobSeskaShow.com. So if you've been paying attention for the last several months of shows, you know that I've been plugging this brand new book by Jeff Charlotte called The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. I swear to God, it's one of the most important volumes of our time, documenting Trumpism, the rise of fascism throughout Trump country. So, of course, my guest today is the author of that book, Jeff Charlotte. He's conducted some of the best reporting I've read in a long time, and his prose, oh my God, it's beyond awesome. Jeff literally put himself in harm's way, visiting some of these mega churches and Trump rallies on the ground while also engaging with many of the disciples along the way. So please take some time to pick up a copy of The Undertow. I got a link in the description on the Patreon page and at BobSeska.com. Meantime, don't forget to support this podcast by subscribing to us on Patreon, BobSeskaShow.com. Okay, here's my talk with journalist Jeff Charlotte.
More fun!
I've been quoting your book for weeks and weeks now, so it's a real honor to talk with you today, Jeff.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate it.
So I guess we'll start here. Last night, the Republicans nominated an insurrectionist to be speaker. The Times called this guy, Mike Johnson, the most important architect of the coup. This isn't going away, is it, Jeff?
No, it's growing. And I think actually, as I'm speaking to you now, I'm just closing on a new magazine story with my friend Catherine Joyce on what we perceive as a left to right slide, you know, a former leftist or let people perceive to be leftist, the Glenn Greenwalds, the Matt Taibbis and so on, more and more making common cause with the right. And I think there's a temptation for us to look at the Republican Party in apparent disarray and say, ha ha, and to look at those who are moving rightward and say, so long, good riddance, we didn't need you. But what we're missing there is, I think, the black hole of fascism, which is exerting a really powerful gravitational force. And, you know, whether that's enough, you know, by the time this airs, we'll know whether that was enough to make Mike Johnson, Representative Mike Johnson of Louisiana, the first 100% pro-insurrection coup speaker of the House. Well, but either way, it shows that the power that power is there. And I think that's what I mean, I'm using the metaphor of the black hole there, but I've got another metaphor, which is the title of the book, The Undertow, which is these really powerful currents. And even when we're not paying attention to them, they are pulling us rightward.
What is the Venn diagram overlap? What is causing this horseshoe effect you were mentioning between, you know, the whatever, I can't even define exactly what they are, that category of people that includes Glenn Greenwald and Matt Taibbi and all of them. What is the common cause with the far right that they're finding? And this is the loaded part of the question. Is it the grift? Are they all seeing the business model in participating in politics this way?
So I think the answer to so many of these questions we can learn from improv comedy, it's yes, yes, and. You know, it's always, and you're talking about, you use the metaphor of Venn diagram. Yeah. I mean, that's our clue. It's yes, and. It's many things at once. Mm-hmm. I actually, that horseshoe theory, which is this idea that the extreme left and the extreme right, you know, kind of curve around to meet one another and that they're both further from the center, which isn't really a theory. It comes to us from a French novelist. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's correct. Naomi Klein in her new book, and here I am selling other people's books, Doppelganger, writes about
great book.
These theorists who are sort of looking at a German process during the pandemic, and they're calling it diagonalism, right? Mm. But I think I'm going to go with the yes and, the improv theory, the yes and theory.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit like what I'm trying to get at with in the central essay of the book of Ashley Babbitt, who, instead of looking at these sort of, I'm always more interested in like, what's happened to Taibbi, what happened to Greenwald? I don't know them. And they're not, you know, giving me access to their journals.
Yeah.
But Ashley Babbitt, I was able to look at really, really closely. This is, of course, the 30-something-year-old white woman who led a charge in the Capitol on January 6th, right, wearing a Trump flag, not unarmed, as is commonly said. The cover photo of my book is the knife she was carrying to, as she put it, storm the Capitol. Hmm. And she was shot dead and killed and became a martyr of the right wing of the fascist movement. And so many folks, after she died, I was as fascinated by the ways they went searching in her past for confirmation that Ashley was always trash. And now her mother has, who is apolitical, her mother has become a fascist. In the book, I write about the moment where you can almost see it happening.
Yeah.
She's at a podium. She's crying. And some Black Lives Matter protesters are chanting, trying to drown her out with Black Lives Matter. And she just clicks from grief for her daughter to rage, and she decides to direct it at them and starts chanting to their Black Lives Matter. She starts chanting Ashley Babbitt, but no one is born a fascist.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whether you're making some money or you're finding community or you're just brokenhearted or disillusioned, or as in Ashley Babbitt's case, who had been a kind of default, I say a default liberal most of her life, but actually in her circles where not a lot of folks had access to a full college education, they didn't have any language like neoliberalism or anything like that. They didn't have that critique. She was the one who was always Googling and telling people about Obama and so on. But she saw this undertow. She saw herself getting in insurmountable debt. Yep. Interest rates no honest person could pay, you know, to quote Bruce Springsteen, Atlantic City, right? Mm-hmm. She saw herself in Southern California, blue Southern California, where the houselessness problem has always been big and has been exploding. And she didn't have the language for saying, you know, structural this or that. She was just looking at guys shitting in her front yard. And I think there's a moment, you know, we speak sometimes of compassion fatigue. I don't excuse where she went, but there was a moment when Donald Trump came along and she's like, you know what? Instead of trying to be a good person, what if I just lean back into this undertow?
Yeah.
What if I stop swimming against the current? What if I just let it carry me? Let whiteness carry me? Let my anger carry me? Let my blame other people carry me? And I think that far more than the grift, which is never persuasive to me. And I've been writing about the right. And for years and years, everyone, I'm like, maybe, I mean, everyone's got to eat. People like to get paid. But that doesn't mean that they don't come to believe what they believe.
Does Ashley Babbitt's mom understand that what she wants is fascism? I mean, do they grasp that where this is all heading is sort of toward this idiocratic version of fascism in the United States? Do they get that?
Some do. I don't think Ashley Babbitt's mother does. I think she has, you know, nor Ashley Babbitt's Aaron Babbitt, who was a sort of big bodybuilder lunkhead who adored Ashley, was not political. And like you go back, you know, before the end, another thing people don't know about Ashley Babbitt is that she was queer in practice, if not a name. They were a threesome, Ashley, Aaron, and they had a girlfriend who lived with them. And and there's like these sweet videos almost, except you ignore what's happening, where the girlfriend and Aaron were like make videos of Ashley like leaning in, watching a Trump rally. They thought it was ridiculous and boring. They thought Trump was stupid. Who cares? They live by the beach. Let's go to the beach. They didn't want to do this stuff. They had, you know, they had fruit trees in their front yard. We have a good life. Why are you going toward this, Ashley?
Yeah.
Now he too is a fascist. And I think the fascists, look, what fascism does is it's very good at exploiting grief.
Yeah.
And transforming it into anger, and yet telling you that anger is a kind of love. And I think there are folks within this fascist movement who understand that what they're doing is fascism, who understand, who are explicitly and openly against democracy, the folks who are admiring Putin, looking to Hungary's Viktor Orban, who still says he's doing democracy, but he's saying it's illiberal democracy. Mm-hmm. You know, the democracy where not everyone gets a say, that democracy. And I think it, certainly Stephen Miller, Steve Bannon, you know, there's a lot of intellectuals in this movement. I don't think people sort of recognize that.
Yeah.
They don't need, you know, and they, of course, they understand like, hey, why don't we just call the left fascism? No, I'm not a fascist. You're a fascist. You're a fascist.
Yeah, right. I know, but what am I?
Called a library with history books that we can go and we can find out what words mean, right? There is, you can point to authoritarianism on the left. It's there. It's not fascism. That's a different thing.
Yeah.
That's a word that means a thing. And it means a cult of personality. It means a purification project, usually around ethnic terms, but not necessarily exactly. Mm-hmm. It means an idea of mystic destiny. And most of all, I think it means a reverence for violence.
Yeah.
Not just that, like, American politics has always had violence. But violence as redemptive, as regenerative, and this is really important, as fun.
Yeah.
Something that makes you feel good. You see that in the Trump rallies. I try and write about that book. Mm-hmm. Erotic, a militant erotic charge to the way he describes decapitations and disembowelments.
Yeah.
And the protester in the face. It's turning people on.
Right. He seems like eerily fascinated with death and the process of dying. Like, I've seen him talk, and it takes on this weird tone. Like, I remember him talking about how Andrew Jackson's wife died, and he was going on and on about how this woman died while Andrew Jackson was president in this extremely kind of morbid, eerie way. It was so strange to hear, especially someone who is so known for his toxic positivity. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the inner goth girl of Donald Trump. But I think there's also that's true. One of the things I read in the book, I'm always interested in the aesthetics of fascism.
Yeah.
And some people say, well, that's just branding or whatever. No, fascism is a movement. It's not so much an ideology as an aesthetics. It grows in the modern sense out of an Italian avant-garde artistic movement called futurism. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's what, you know, and the art, futuristic art was fabulous. It's not bad, but it was fascist. And Trump is, I think, primarily, I would argue, an aesthetic project. But that project of, I like your term, toxic positivity, right?
Yeah.
He's so inspired, as I write, by Norman Vincent Peale, the best-selling author of,
The Power of Positive Thinking.
The power of positive thinking, whom he calls his pastor, a guy who said, like, basically the whole message of the Christianity is how to be a good salesman, you know?
Yeah,
sell, right? But the flip side of that, and a guy with a will to power like Trump, and we know he's a germaphobe, and we know he's speaking to a kind of fear of death, which is a fascination of death. And I look at the imagery that surrounds it, and especially, most especially, the Punisher skulls. You see them on flags, you see them on shirts, you see them on trucks. Yeah. And I mean, I remember being at one Trump rally, a whole family, and they must have had these made, mom, dad, kids, and they were like the pink ladies from Greece. They all had these pink jackets with bedazzled Trump Punisher skulls. This is a Punisher skull.
Oh my
with
God.
A swirl of Trump hair on top of it. So what's with all these skulls? The Totenkopf, forgive my German, but the death head of fascism. And I think it is a way of, I think, you know, there's a lot of theorizing with this over the years, and sort of the denial of death. When I'm out on the road and I see a truck, you know what a coal roller is?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
That are goosed up to like, hey, not only am I not gonna, you know, not waste gas, I'm gonna waste as much as I can and be as loud and gross about it in the smoke. Like, that's not, people look at that as climate change. Someone doesn't believe in climate change, and I'm like, no, I actually think I look at that in person. I think I see someone who believes in it. I tell a story like this. There's something called Yiddish. It was the language of the Eastern European Jews, pre-Holocaust.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a very radical community in America. There was a huge Yiddish anarchist community, right? And they're anarchists, they reject God, and they're radicals and everything else. And on Yom Kippur, the high holy day of Judaism, where you're supposed to fast, they would have a pig roast. Right?
Yeah.
Which is not kosher. but that's not saying, if you really don't believe in God, what do you do on Yom Kippur? Same thing you did the day before. Who cares?
Right.
This is, see how much I don't believe in you? That's what the coal rollers are. Yeah. See how much I reject this fear, the heat that I too can feel, the flooding that I too see, but I refuse to accept it. That's Ashley Babbitt, you know?
Wow.
Who sees the brokenness of things and then says, hey, you know what? What if I just say no and it feels awesome? And here's this powerful man and I know he's blessed because look how rich he is. And I follow him, and she did, to her death.
Yep. Is this movement built around the drive toward fascism, or is it a rejection of democracy? Or is it maybe a combination of the two of the things? I mean, it could very easily be that. But I find that when I was reading The Undertow and all the other research I've been doing as part of my job, is I see this... this giving up, this kind of, I don't know what you would call it, the politics of sweatpants. I'm just going to wear sweatpants around all day because I've given up on democracy. It's too hard to convince people using words and votes. So therefore, we have to fight them. What's the line of thinking along those lines, Jeff?
Yes, and. I only have one answer here. It's like, yeah. No, but I'll say this. Look, I think, you know, as someone who, and I know you've been thinking about this for a long time, and someone who's been studying right-wing movements in the United States, around the world, usually firsthand by immersing myself in them for 20 years, and sort of looking at social movement theory, I hear sometimes from it, I identify as a left, and I hear from left friends like, well, you know, it's horrible, but it's always been like this. And I'm going to tell you, no, it hasn't. That what's happened is that the right was never monolithic. And there was all kinds of different, which is good, right? There's all kinds of fractions and so on. And that's what allowed the sort of establishment conservatism to reign supreme, right? The factions couldn't line up. When a social movement, left, right, whatever, becomes powerful is when, for whatever reason, those currents get strong enough and it starts converging. So when you got Proud Boys marching with traditionalist Catholics and evangelicals, these are folks who do not get along, right? With libertarians who don't believe in God, you have all these folks coming together. Then you have this really powerful thing. So you got the sweatpants people, and you have the people like Notre Dame, brilliant Notre Dame scholar Patrick Deneen, of the post-liberalism, who's saying, you know, maybe democracy doesn't really work exactly. But, you know, these are the guys who've been doing the deep reading and thinking about it. They're all moving in the same direction. We saw that on January 6th. It's easy. The myth of the mob, right, is always that the unity it finds in its rage must have preceded it. But all we got to do is to start picking out the strands of the people who showed up at January 6th. And that's actually much scarier. If it was just one gang, right? One gang of several thousand, but these people were coming from all over. They're coming, Ashley Babbitt from Southern California, a former Democrat, Proud Boys, military veterans. Yes, we know that, but they weren't all right wing. I write in the book about a guy named George Riley, who I met in Sacramento at an Ashley Babbitt rally, describes himself as a Iroquois French-Canadian Jew. And then he waits a beat and he says, for Jesus. Mm-hmm. And he raided the Capitol wearing what he described as his war paint and feathers in his hair, and was meaning and saying, I'm taking my land back, understood himself as a Native American. And if you see, he's an outlier, by the way. Right now, last statistic I just saw is that 40% of the Native American community is leaning toward Trump. Wow. And this is what I'm trying to tell people, is no one's immune. Yeah. Fascism has a big gravity, and it can draw, you know, that's why I use that black hole. The black hole is like drawing in all the debris around it. It's not distinguishing between it. And that sounds terrifying and nihilistic. It's accurate, but also I think if you can recognize it, you can kind of change your strategies. Because right now, you know, so many of us who like democracy, the left, the liberal, we keep imagining someone else is going to save us. We keep imagining that some constituency, the young will save us. The young voters don't go for this. Well, one, they do. And two, I've been hearing the young will save us since I was young 30 years ago. It's not going to
right.
Diversification will save us.
Mm-hmm.
As I write in the book, and Anthea Butler, I'll sell another book on your show, Anthea Butler's White Evangelical Racism. If you're looking for a short, sweet, sharp primer into how this stuff works, that you can't do better than that book. She's a historian of the Black church, and she's looking at, among other things, how white evangelical racism works. But she talks about something called the promise of whiteness. Huh. And it's an old force in American life, by which whiteness, because it's not, whiteness isn't a real thing. It's an abstraction.
Yeah.
So, you know, you take a character like Candace Owen, she gets to get in, who is a Black far-right commentator. She gets to get in on that so-called promise. And that pulls people in. When you look at that and you say, okay, so diversification alone is not going to save us. The youth alone are not going to save us. What are you left with? Save ourselves. We got to organize. Nothing, you know, there's no cavalry coming. We're it.
Right. That's terrifying. Because I take a look around and I'm like, we're it? Oh my God. Jeez, that's
you
horrible.
And me, Bob.
Yeah. That's right. You know, one of the through lines in the book is this marriage between megachurch grifters and Republican politics, not only in terms of ideology, but in terms of style. When did this business model start forming? When did obviously the MAGA movement is the current formation of this, but in terms of Republicanism embracing this way of manipulation, this means of dazzling an audience with lights and music and spectacle and rage and all of these things that trigger our lizard brain, how did this style begin forming as a means of furthering political ends? How did that sort of traveling roadshow kind of Steve Martin in Leap of Faith, that sort of thing. How did that get started?
Well, I'm going to go with maybe the Ulysses S. Grant era.
Wow.
I think what happened with the particular formation of the Christian right that begins sort of, or it comes to the attention of the secular press in the 1980s around Reagan, and there hardens into this kind of conventional wisdom that there is a religious right and that there is a business right. And these two things do exist. But that becomes such a concretized idea that it obscures the very real Venn diagram that had been there. And I say I say going back to the late 19th century, because in my previous book of mine called The Family, I'm looking at like one of the very first mega churches built in the United States, which was built in the late 19th century by a guy named Charles Grandison Finney, who is remembered affectionately because he was an abolitionist. And, you know, God bless him for that. Mm-hmm. He was also a fierce anti-labor activist, and boy, did he know how to put on a show and build a big church. And I mean, it was fabulous, right? So I say, like, that marriage was there. The Family, that organization that runs the National Prayer Breakfast, they begin in the 1935 with the conviction that the FDR's New Deal is an affront to God, and that the United States' drift towards socialism is causing the Depression because God is punishing it. So they say, let's get godly men together. Where do you find godly men? The National Association of Manufacturers, of course. You can tell. I mean, they're rich. How could they be rich if they if God didn't bless them? And, you know, this group has been, do they still exist? Yes, Mike Pence. Well, Mike Pence, maybe not so powerful, right? But the transaction that we saw in Trump, that did change, right? So it's always been a little closer.
Yeah.
But Trump, you know, everyone said, like, it's why I resist the word grift, because grift sort of suggests that it's like that the deal doesn't change you. Mike Pence and Trump made a deal. Trump looked around. He says, who do I need? And he needed the Christian, Christian nationalists. And he started, he said, he did some very smart things. He said, you know, because remember in the beginning, the big Christian right warlords were against him. And he says, I don't care. Most people don't really know who they are. If I just get some pastors and I put pictures of the pastors with me, most people don't know who they are.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this is blessed, right? And it worked. He made that deal. It's a transaction. But Trump knows this. Everyone knows this. Mm-hmm. The transaction transforms you. I'm not saying that Trump got God. I'm saying that Trumpism, the fascism that grew out of it, became something else. And the Christian nationalism of Mike Pence, which had always been quite friendly toward big business, became something else, that they transformed one another. And this is a really essential point, I argue. I'm talking about this earlier book of mine called The Family. Yeah. I got a chapter in that book called The F Word. The F word is fascism. Yeah. And in that, I argued that even though The Family, which actually recruited post-World War II Nazi war criminals to advise its U.S. Congress members, and the Nazis who wouldn't be allowed in the United States, they would fly congressmen over to take counsel with them. I still said, look, this is not fascism. Because they said, look, we'll redeem you, but you got to switch out the Führer for the Father. You got to worship God. I thought that fundamentalism in America would prevent full fascism from coming to bloom because we would never have a cult of personality. Our fundamentalists wouldn't allow it. They love Jesus too much. I was wrong.
Yeah.
I was wrong. And I write that in the book. Trump brought the aesthetic of the strong man, which is we've seen in so many other countries. Mm-hmm. When he rides down that golden escalator, will we, you know, scare quotes, embrace it? Enough of us did. Enough of us said, yeah, Jesus is okay. And that's where you get to, you know, some of the churches I visit in the book, a church in Yuba City, California. Listeners might have heard it. It became virally famous for a while for presenting on stage General Mike Flynn, customized AR-15. Fascinating thing about that little mega church, they got rid of their crosses. They don't have any crosses. The pulpit's made of swords. The pastor explained to me, it's wartime now. It's time for wartime theology. Oh. And the cross, he says, I love the cross, but it's weak tea.
Oh,
you know, it's not a time for that. It's a time for war. And you can say, oh, well, that's not really Christian. Religion is as religion does. And they are invoking an old, old Crusades tradition. And they're not the only ones. I saw churches across the country. I write about two in the book. Yeah. They have their own militias. And these aren't backwoods redneck churches. These are suburban mega churches. Monday night, men's group. Wednesday night, youth group. Tuesday, new militia recruit night. Men with guns lining the back. Men with guns who escorted me out at one of these churches. That's new. That part is new. That militance is new.
Yeah. So they're not just indoctrinating their disciples in terms of wrapping their heads around the idea of civil war. They're literally recruiting soldiers for the civil war. Is that what's happening?
Well, so part of it, what happened, so the undertow, you know, the undertow began actually before January 6th. I was like, all right, I've been reporting on these movements for so long. Mm-hmm. And I see some of these currents that are coming through. So some of the early chapters are looking at the so-called men's rights movement and the prosperity gospel and all these kinds of things. And I said, look, this Trumpism didn't come out of nowhere. You know, people have been dismissing as fringe, and suddenly all the fringes converge and it's a big river, right? Mm-hmm. But then on January 6th, I mean, even though I'd been reporting it, I was like, this is amazing. And I started hearing academic historians, scholarly historians. I'm married to one, and I know that historians are necessarily cautious. They know that history usually moves slow.
Yeah.
And that language, Civil War talk was hyperbolic or fringe. But now the historians were saying, the conditions for Civil War. Oh, that's pretty scary. So I decided to go out and, you know, drive around and start talking to folks. And the answer to my question, Civil War, was a variation on the improv question. It was yes and. It wasn't yes or no. It was yes and I'm sorry about that, but it must happen, or yes and I can't wait. And this, that church with the militia I'm talking about in Omaha, Nebraska, they're preaching Civil War. They keep on saying, no, we're not sure. They used to talk about the rapture, we don't know when the date will be. Now they're like, we don't know when the Civil War is coming, but it is coming. Arm up, get ready. Does that mean it's going to happen? No, nothing's inevitable.
Yeah.
Big cry of fascism is inevitability. But does it mean that all over the country you find people preparing for it, and that is going to shape our culture and politics, whether or not we come to blows? Yes, that's where we're in. People say, could there be political violence? Are fools. We are living with political violence now. It's simmering in a thousand ways. It's simmering in all the pregnant people who are suffering for lack of reproductive rights, the wave of trans and queer suicide amongst youth who are despairing. Suicide has many causes, but one of them we know is kids who you can't tell them they're being paranoid anymore. The states are out to get them. They really are. We see just the sparks of violence where you have men with guns lining up outside school libraries, you know?
Yeah.
And so far, no shootings happened. So people say, well, it's okay, no shootings happened. This is like taking some matches and lighting them and flicking them into a dry field. Thank God the flames don't catch. And then telling yourself, well, I guess that's a safe activity. You know, sooner or later, it's going to be fire.
Yeah. So if the flames do catch, what form does that take? Do they have any sense in terms of the actual format for this coming civil war? Like, are we talking about guerrilla warfare? Are we talking about sectarian violence? Are we talking about bombings here and there, mass shootings? Or do they have in their mind, you know, 1,000 guys in gray uniforms marching against 1,000 guys in blue uniforms in the middle of a farm field in Pennsylvania somewhere? What is
nobody has that in mind, and that's the good news, right? But the bad news, and here I actually defer those. A great review of my book. It was great because it made a point that I didn't make. It was smarter than anything I made by a writer for New York Magazine named Sarah Jones, grew up in that world, in the sort of evangelical right world.
Yeah.
And she's sort of saying, you know, the Civil War is not a battlefield. The Civil War is all, you know, it's sort of permeating everything. People who are seceding in their everyday lives, right? I think, so you get characters I write in penultimate chapter of the book is about Wisconsin, which when Roe fell became the only blue state to suddenly revert to 1849 law forbidding any abortion for any reason. And I went around traveling folks, and I ended up meeting a guy in Marinette, Wisconsin. Rob Brum was the leader of a militia he claimed was 5,000 to 6,000 strong. And I think that was an exaggeration, probably a big exaggeration, but it was definitely there. I mean, you saw the evidence. I mean, they were doing trainings. They had serious armaments and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob doesn't imagine, he was at January 6th, strange character, was at January 6th, was carrying, by the way, was carrying his gun and so on. And at the same time, like so many of these characters, says it was a hoax. And I'm like, but Rob, are you a hoax? You were there. But Rob does not imagine marching on the Capitol. Mm. And I think when you get into the real imagination, there was a Louisiana congressman a little while ago who had a thing about, like, you know, everyone is laughing. Look at these knuckleheads. He had this like weird militia jargon talk, like know your bridges and so on, and some numbers. I'm like, this makes no sense. It makes sense. He was talking about the ratio of military grade maps, get military grade maps, know your bridges, because what's happening, as has happened in various parts of the country, Shasta County, California has effectively seceded. There's parts of Wisconsin that have effectively seceded. What Rob imagines is anyone who comes in from outside to enforce, he's got his militia. Yeah, well, it's easy. Okay, don't go in to enforce. All right, now start imagining some scenarios. Start imagining the folks who we know, or maybe listeners don't know, are working in red states to provide underground abortions. What happens if one of these states with heavy laws, Texas, decides that they're going to arrest a New Yorker? Yeah. And they're going to put that New Yorker away in prison for a long time. And New York says, give us our person back. Suddenly now we're something. Let's pay attention to Ron DeSantis's his white alligator private militia, not answerable to federal power.
Yeah.
That's an old playbook. That's a segregation playbook. He's hinting that, you know, he'll stand in the doorway. Maybe he will. Maybe he won't.
Yeah. And that's Florida's in effect a fascist state at this point, isn't it?
I mean,
in the loosest possible sense.
It's got the apparatus
to
keep building toward that. And I think it's important to remember that if it is, the good news is we know how horrible it is, but if it is a fascist state, it's quite a weak one because we see DeSantis trying to enforce things on, you know, so-called blue areas, and sometimes he can and sometimes he can't, right?
Yeah.
So he doesn't have that kind of full power. We see the hints of the police state, police arresting people for voting and things like that and so on. It's not full-fledged. And this is why I always say, like, this is not an animal. I don't know if you saw the news. There's a little story in Franklin, Tennessee. And for those who don't know, that's a very wealthy and conservative suburb outside Nashville, where a lot of the sort of, you know, the bro country elite reside. And they had a city council member who was running for mayor of their town. And she had when I call these folks Nazis, I'm not speaking figuratively or insulting them. That's just their bag. They're Nazis. she had a Nazi honor guard, right? But other than that, she really spoke the language of contemporary conservatism. She was a Trumper. And she got thrashed in their election.
Wow.
Every candidate, in fact, who the so-called Moms for Liberty endorsed got thrashed. And so that to me is very, very promising.
Yeah.
And it's what happens when we start looking beyond cable news and into these little local stories. And that's sort of why I try to do my book the way I did. Instead of like the big abstraction, I just drive around the country and say, like, what's happening here? What's happening there? That helps me understand that my own very blue state of Vermont is not as blue as people think.
Yeah.
I drive across the state and see so many Trump flags, so many Gadsden flags, Confederate flags, and worst of all, I write about this, this is the scariest one. If you see this on your neighbor flying it, watch out. It's an American flag, but it's all black. It's a shades of black, not the Blue Lives Matter flag, the black and white with a blue stripe. This is shades of black. And what it means for those who fly it is a belief in a coming civil war, but not only that, a commitment to taking no prisoners. Kill everybody.
Jesus Christ, yeah.
It is a genocide. That doesn't mean that the knucklehead who flies it is actually going to do that, but it means he's dreaming of it.
Okay, we're going to pause for a short break. We'll be back with more Jeff Charlotte right after these words.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Bob Seska.
You know, one thing I always contend with as a podcaster and a writer, Jeff, is sometimes when I talk about people like Donald Trump or the MAGA movement or what I've seen on Fox News Channel or heard on AM talk radio, I get this pushback. Why are you giving these people more air and paying attention to what they're saying? And my reaction to that is, and I'll put it in the form of a question for you, Jeff, which is, should liberals, moderates, et cetera, normals in general terms, spend more time learning about what's happening on the other side, learning about things like the flag you were just talking about, or exposing themselves to what's happening in some of these mega churches? Should we be more ensconced and knowledgeable in terms of this brewing fascism that's taking place? Or is it better to just kind of go la, 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 not listening?
I mean, it's definitely better for your health to go la la la, not listening.
I know.
But they knock on your door.
I wish I could do that.
Then it's not so good for your health. Yeah. Look, I will say this. You know, first of all, the question: why are you giving them air? We're not giving them anything. This is the imagination that we are still the center. That somehow that they are the fringe. No, yeah. Friend. If we're talking on a liberal show, we're the fringe. And people say, but there's more of us than are of them. And I'm like, tell me, show me a fascist country that where fascism ever came to power with a majority. That's not what it does. That's right. Not what it does. That's not the threat. And yeah, you're right. If there's a fair election, we wouldn't lose. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's not even an if. Like if that's a hypothetical that won't happen, right? It's not going to be a fair election, right? So we have to contend with this, right? But I do say I'm an all hands on deck guy. I'm a popular front guy. You don't want to do this. You want to go la 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 because you're going to say, like, you know what? My good deed is I'm going to go work in my local soup kitchen. Great. Mm-hmm. You don't need to learn it. You don't need to buy my book. You're going to say I'm working on this program where I'm doing a community garden. Great. That's enough. You're in the fight. Or how about you? I just love my local library. Well, now you're on the front lines. Now you're on the front lines. And that's where I say, like, you do need to learn about it, because if you're not doing any of those things, yeah, you need to be. I don't care what you do, but you need to be engaged in building a vital democratic culture, because the opposite of fascism is not anti-fascism. It's democracy. And democracy is not something we have. It's something we do. You got to make up it. Every day you wake up, you make the democracy, just like the donuts, right? Yeah. You've got to do it. And you can do it on any front. And maybe you say, all I need to know is that it's dangerous, so I'm going to go work on my school board. Or maybe you want to say, hey, look, I want to understand this, because what's happening now with school boards has happened before. It's how that moral majority of the 70s and 80s formed. They noticed, hey, you know what? You know what? We can't get it. We can't really get folks elected to Congress right now. But you know where nobody goes? School boards.
Yeah,
and they
right.
took a lot of school boards. And that's, now I'm seeing, the great news is I'm seeing folks pushing back. I was given a reading in my hometown. I was connecting New York, upstate New York, a little blue dot, but a mostly kind of red area. And all the school boards in the area were contested, and all but one beat them back. That's great, because people paid attention, because they said, you know, I'd rather be having fun and watching sports, but I got to know about this, and I might have to go down to that meeting, and I might have to get involved. Because this isn't somewhere else. This is right here. I'm sitting talking to you now in Hanover, New Hampshire. Very, 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 very blue. My kid is over there at the high school, and I have a queer child, and we have a well-funded group that is challenging, threatening the jobs of queer teachers, scaring the hell out of my kid and others. And I'm in la 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 land. Mm-hmm. And I think the imagination that this is somewhere else is the delusion that no one can afford. Now, how you resolve that, you don't have to read my book. I think it's a pretty good book. It's pretty entertaining, and there's some hope in it. But, you know, if you'd rather read novels, that's fine. But unless you want to learn about this, the day your rights get taken away, you better pay attention.
Well, you absolutely put your ass on the line for this book. And as I was reading through it, I kept thinking about what Trump says about journalists perpetually. Every time he gets a chance, he calls them, of course, the enemies of the people. And whenever I think about that, Jeff, I go to some of the reporting that I see in some papers of record, certainly on cable news, and the people who normalize all of this. And I wonder if they're aware that Trump is likely going to come for the enemies of the people first. You know, when I see, you know, someone downplaying the impact of Trumpism or something on cable news, I'm like, do you not understand that you're at the top of the list in all of this? He keeps talking about the enemies of the people. He's talking about you on cable news channel X. Is that something that ever occurs to you as far as what the ramifications of this are? I mean,
it's breaking my heart, Bob, because I have to say, I knew that the media might do in 2020 for 2024 a replay of 2020. I didn't know they were going to do a replay of 2016.
Yeah, it's exactly and look, it.
Some people have changed. Some people get it, and that's good. But it's astonishing. And I think, I mean, I've been involved in media criticism for a long time, going back to the early 2000s and working with a great media critic named Jay Rosen. And he's got a terrific formulation.
Oh, yeah.
For press. He says, you've got to follow the stakes. Not the odds, right? The odds. Nikki Haley's up, Nikki Haley's down. Doesn't matter. What's at stake, right? What's at stake? And so we see a lot of the press doing odds coverage right now. We see that denial. The second book event I did for the Undertow virtual event, very friendly bookstore. They thought this would be a great idea. And they invited a New York Times, senior New York Times political reporter named Reed Epstein. Kind of a centrist guy. He's been called out a few times for his a little bit of bias, but whatever. He's no fascist. He's not a fascist at all. But he, in fact, it was a very strange book event because he was supposed to be my speaking partner. And he made clear right away that he hadn't read the book, wouldn't read the book, because the New York Times did all the reporting that mattered. And he didn't think we needed to use these dirty words, the F word, the R word. Racist. I was like, okay, all right. I respect it. I don't share it, but let me understand it. And I wanted to understand what his historical understanding of fascism was. Now, if he had one, he wouldn't tell me. It seemed to be that he thought the F word, fascist, was like the N word. It was just a dirty word, right? But no, it's a word with meaning. And I feel like I've got some credibility here because I haven't been throwing it at everybody I don't like forever and ever. I wrote a book in which I said, hey, I think it's overstated, and there's more than one kind of bad under the sun. Not every kind of bad is fascist.
Right.
This kind is. Yep. We can look at the historical scholars. I recommend a book called Anatomy of Fascism by Robert O. Paxton, a great historian, but writing in an accessible way, drawing on all the European movements. Now, that limits it because, of course, fascism is a global problem, but it does give you some programs to do that. So I will say, look, there's been some improvement in the media. Like 10 years ago, I write for mainstream publications and so on. If I use the term white supremacy, not a chance was going to get in. Now, you know, Fox News will use the term white supremacy. It's not a contest. We know, you know, it's there. Even the F word, fascist, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get shut down. You know, someone might say, no, I'm against using it. But it's on the table. Authoritarian, the Washington Post has been lately describing Trumpism as a functionally authoritarian movement. And I can name reporters who are good, but I can also say this, and I'll say this, and I say this to every liberal audience, right? Every time you read an article by Maggie Haberman in the New York Times that you hate, and this happens because I criticize the media a lot, people say, that's why you canceled my subscription. I'm like, oh, great. You really struck a blow for freedom. Trump is quaking now.
That's a great point. Yeah.
It's a failure to understand that media organizations are vast, always dissatisfying, but the big ones with the big resources can do things that I can't do. You know, I don't have a team. I don't have a whole data team to work with me. I can't dig in on, I don't have the expertise to dig in like David Fahrenthold on taxes and things like that, tax returns. Those are big media organizations, and we must contest them, fight them, push back, and so on. Yeah. But we don't abandon them any more than we abandon democracy because we're so disappointed by our choices.
Is there any hope, Jeff, for America to pull up on the controls before we crash into the ground? Is this going to resolve? Are cooler heads going to prevail?
I'm going to go with, I'm hoping for the warmer heads. I'm not the hot heads. The folks who are warm with love. The folks, I mean that in a little bit of a preacherly sense. Is there any hope? There's all the hope in the world. Yeah. Hope is not something that you have. Mm. And I forgive me, liberals, because I know where a lot of us are upset that Brother Cornel West is running. And I think he's doing the wrong thing too, but I've spent a lot of time with him over the years and he is a wise, wise man. This is a mistake. But he makes that critical point that hope is not something you experience. You don't like say, well, I've studied for my test. I hope I do well. That's not hope. Mm-hmm. That's a calculation of the odds. Hope is what's there when there's no reason to think.
Yeah.
I haven't studied for my test at all and I know nothing. I hope I get through this. Hope is rooted in despair, right? And I think we're all familiar with the possibility that despair was there in your question, right?
Yeah.
And that means the hope is there too. And that means though the cooler heads, no, the technocracy is not going to get us through it. The technocrats, mm-hmm. We're not going back to normal. How can we, but we voted for Joe Biden. How come we're going back to normal? Because I don't know what physics you learned in high school. You can't go back in time.
Yeah.
This shit happened. Mm. And you know who's really clear-eyed about this? The never-Trumpers. Those senior Republican officials who are never-Trumpers.
Yeah.
They are clear-eyed than so many liberal pundits. They're like, yeah, no, we're never going back. The Republican Party is not savable. It is fascist. I know. I helped make it that way. A lot of them take accountability. Mm-hmm. And they say, this is not a, we can't go back. You know, in the book, I quote my kids' favorite children's book when they're little, and it's got a family keeps encountering, they're going on a bear hunt. They just want to see a bear, and they keep encountering a big river or whatever. And each time there's a little refrain, can't go under it, can't go over it, just got to go through it. Mm-hmm. And that's banal and simple, but good God, how much of our political class is dedicated to pretending that we don't have to go through it. There's a lot of hope. There's going to be a lot of suffering. We're going to go through it. But I really do, actually. I'm an optimist. I think people have a hard time seeing that in this book, but I am. That's why I close it in. We haven't talked about it. I close and end it with people are like, what's Harry Belafonte doing at the beginning of the book? One, he's got the best diagnosis of whiteness and white supremacy I have encountered. Two, because he was, when he died at 96, he died full of joy and full of anger. That man was in the struggle all his life. Like Harry Belafonte, the banana boat guy. And I'm like, yeah, that's the way people sometimes get smoothed down, sanded off. And like, we forget he was a deeply radical man, instrumental to the civil rights movement. And he reminds us of the long struggle. What's going to happen if Trump is elected in November in 2024? I mean, I had the good fortune of at a very young age having two heart attacks the week before Trump was elected in 2016.
Oh my God.
I made it through. And so I was the guy who woke up and was like, whew, well, looks like fascism may be coming to America.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky to be alive to see it, you know, like what's going to happen the next day and the next day. The struggle is long. And I think we got to resist that crisis. The sky is falling, man. The sky has always been falling.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean like do nothing. I mean, the struggle is long, but I think there's a lot of hope.
Yeah, it's interesting. Speaking of never Trumpers, I think it was Tom Nichols at some point tweeted something along the lines of, you know what? Ultimately, at the end of the day, life for humans on this planet has never been better than it is right now.
I'm not doing that.
You know, you won't go that far.
No, I won't go that far. In fact, I just did an event with Jeff Toobin and he was a smart guy. He's got a new book about Timothy McVeigh and those roots of the right and so on. But he was kind of taking the line of like, you know, let's keep things in perspective. U.S. poverty is lower. And he said, you know, America used to be an apartheid state. And this is where he got me. And he says, you know, and like, you know, 20 years ago, you couldn't be a gay kid in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I'm in Cincinnati. And I'm like, yeah, this, but you know, we can visit our friend Charles Dickens to help understand this. Tale of Two Cities, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that apartheid state, one, we got a whole lot of folks who are dedicated to rebuilding it. Two, our schools are more segregated now than they were under that apartheid state. Isn't that amazing? Three, it might be better to be queer in New York City, but in 20 states, my own child is criminalized.
Yeah.
It is the best of times. It is the worst of times.
Perfect.
It is, I'm not with Nichols on that. But and Nichols rejects the term fascist, but I don't care. We're fighting the same. We're fighting the same fight. And yeah. I think we shoulder to shoulder.
The book is called The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. It is a must-read volume, required reading. I got a link in the description under this episode to go and buy it right now. You can also follow Jeff at Jeff Charlotte on Twitter or whatever the hell it's called right now. Jeff, thank you so much for joining me today. This is a huge honor. Your book, oh my God, it's the book of the year as far as I'm concerned. And it's something we all need to stick our faces in that white hot plasma stream and get a sense of what's going on out there so we're better prepared and we can better deal with all of it. Congratulations on this book, Jeff.
Thanks very much, Bob.
Thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's fall into each other. The light is fading fast. The days are few, so let us do each one like it's the last. The stream will be a river before the claws of dread grab my heart and make it smart with things I should have said. You never hear it coming. It's faint enough to miss. So listen for the drumming of a slow apocalypse. Strolling through the suburbs, keep a weather. Fighter jets will pierce the pregnant sky. Refrigerated houses with all the curtains drawn. Tumbleweeds are gaining speed on picture-perfect lawns. You never hear it coming. It's faint enough to miss. So listen for the drumming of a slow apocalypse. Meteor showers will go on for hours before we even notice. In the blinding light, you had better hold tight. To closest. The other side of panic is just a breath away. We're out of time to pantomime the things we ought to say. It's faint enough to miss. So listen for the drumming of a slow apocalypse.